Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
Just ducky, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. We did read a disturbing article in the New York Star-Ledger not too long ago.
You mean the one where I crumpled up the newspaper and threw it across
the
room?
Where you went, ah!
I guess we're talking about the same article.
I handed Francis an article recently, and the reason I think that Francis and I were both irritated by the article is it was in the section called Bamboozled, and no matter where you are in the country, I'm sure you have some either your
the consumer
your local
advocate,
news,
it's
consumer
like not
advocate,
on the job.
Right.
We're going to go and take
exactly.
those merchants who are trying to rip you off, and
exactly,
get
and
your stuff
and
back.
We're going to get your stuff back, exactly. And I have to say, the article itself was written fairly.
But this is in the
but
Bamboozled.
But the fact
me,
that it was in the Bamboozled section was
Bamboozled
an issue for
is
me.
Like where the newspaper team goes out because you brought your car to the lube place
right.
and they said they changed your oil, but they didn't
and,
change
right.
your oil.
Somebody they said you had a new carburetor and you looked under the hood and there was an old carburetor.
Yeah, exactly.
There.
And this doesn't qualify as that, I don't think.
But okay, so tell the story.
All right, so the story is, I will excerpt from the article. It was in the Star-Ledger by Karen Price Miller, who's a very good reporter, by the way.
I agree, and has actually solved some great
yeah,
people who were truly bamboozled.
And I don't think she got this one totally right, but we'll see. The Star-Ledger, April 2013. It came out on April 1st, actually, and she starts off with, "This column isn't an April Fool's joke." Like, this is so crazy. That implies to me that she's saying the actions of the restaurant are like a joke, are so crazy you might mistake them for a joke. Jack and Toby Litsky are vegans. When they both turned 50 last year, they decided to battle high cholesterol by becoming vegan. So they
yada yada yada. You were looking to
they,
say.
It's well written article. We've got only a certain amount of time. So. They came to learn that not all pasta is advertised as 100% is actually 100% whole grain actually is so, and so they've taken to bringing their own pasta to Italian restaurants.
Which is true. You should know that if it says whole grain pasta, it doesn't mean it's 100% whole grain pasta.
Right.
Same thing with whole wheat bread. If it just says whole wheat bread, it does not mean it's 100% whole wheat bread. You need to make sure it says 100% whole wheat
right.
bread on it.
Okay. So the way they've dealt with this is they've gone to at least 50 or 60 restaurants in the past year and a half, and we've never had an issue. Okay. We give them a box of pasta, and they drop it in the water, and we ask if they use red marinara tomato sauce, or we ask for mushrooms and onions and peppers if they have it. And if they've never visited the restaurant before, they call to make sure the kitchen can accommodate them. Okay?
Very reasonable. All of it very reasonable.
To make it easier for servers and chefs, the Liskys took to writing down their dietary needs and cooking instructions on cards, which are handed in when they place their order. Okay, it's a little much, but okay.
It's a little manic, but you know what? A lot of restaurants get it wrong, so I understand why you might be afraid. I mean, you know, Francis and I have talked in the show about a thing called restaurant scars. We understand that you come from other restaurants sometimes
and,
with scars from the mistakes they've made.
And it's cool. It's fine. And we would certainly accommodate that. No problem at all. And here's a quote from Mr. Litsky. "What they typically do is give us a discount. If a pasta dish is $15, they'll charge us $11 or $12 because we brought our own. We don't ask for the discount, but they usually give one." I think that's because you're catching the restaurant off guard and they haven't thought it through. We'll talk about that in a moment.
Yeah, continue through the whole article.
He said the restaurants typically split the uncooked pasta into two servings, which is a box of pasta, which is more than enough to satisfy him and his wife's appetites. Therefore, meaning they don't order appetizers and they don't order desserts. They just have the pasta that they brought. The first time they visited Monticello at Red Bank about a year ago, Litsky said he called ahead to explain their needs and make a reservation for six on a Saturday night. Everything was great. The first time, they charged us $12 each for pasta. A month later, they returned with four co-diners and another box of pasta, and they were charged that amount again. And then on February 23rd, with four new friends and a $50 coupon from restaurants.com, they expected the same thing because, in their view, Monticello had set a precedent And so they assumed they would be charged the same thing. Of course, they didn't come with a coupon the time before, but correct. They set a precedent. Litsky said some of his party ordered chicken, some ordered fish, and the veal parmesan. Litsky handed the waitress – now, they haven't called ahead this time. They handed the waitress a box of pasta in the middle of a busy Saturday night with their $50 coupon and explained what his wife wanted. When the orders arrived, he noticed the pasta portion sizes were smaller than usual, and he said it looked like only half the pasta was cooked. It had mushrooms and onions and olives, a new addition to their diet, which they liked, but he said the olives had pits and were hard to eat. He didn't complain. But he said he enjoyed the meal with his friends. When the bill came, he thought things weren't right. He saw the chicken dishes were $23 or $24, and the fish was $23, and the pasta was $24 each. He asked the waitress to double-check, thinking it was supposed to be maybe $24 for both. When the waitress returned, she said, no, that's the price. He asked to speak to a manager. Manager said, no, that's the price. He asked to speak to the owner. He said, the owner is also the cook. She's cooking. It's the middle of Saturday night right now.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, well, I'll wait. I'll wait until she comes out. So 10 minutes later, the woman stops cooking in her restaurant in the middle of a Saturday night to come out and talk to him. And the quote is, according to him, and this is odd, he says that she said, you've come here on a Saturday night and order a custom meal. I have to charge you at least the price of a regular meal.
Of a regular meal.
And he says, but you've already set the precedent. You charged me a lot less than that on several occasions. And she said, I didn't know about that. That was the old manager's decision, but this is the price. Litsky said he argued that a different price should have been disclosed, but he had never asked the price.
Mm-hmm.
He just assumed. The owner insisted he pay the entire bill. Litsky said the pastas on the menu ranged from 17 to 24. He was charged 24. And he said he offered to compromise and pay 18. And the owner said, no, pay the bill or I'm going to call the police. He said no. She called the police. He explained it to the police. The police said, pay the bill.
Pay the bill or be arrested.
Or be arrested. So he then went home and
called American Express
to dispute the charge. So then this reporter from the Star-Ledger reaches out to the owner. The owner says, listen, I don't even have a $12 pasta on my menu. Why mm-hmm. would I charge him $12? If I did before, that was a mistake. She didn't say that. That's my editorializing. She said she offered to sell the pasta dishes for $20 each at the time, as long as she wouldn't honor the $50 certificate because the $50 certificate says doesn't work if you have a customized dish,
right.
I know that website and that's true.
Okay.
Litsky says she never made that offer, but I don't believe him. Plus, she said she didn't understand why Litsky disputed the entire bill. He said he didn't mean to dispute the entire bill, and then. She came to a compromise. She charged him, when the paper got involved, she charged him $18.
I'm sure here's what's happening now. Some of our listeners right now are saying, well, it should be less. They brought the bulk of the ingredients to the restaurant. And some of our listeners right now are saying, why would you expect to pay less? And I believe that it's Francis and my
view.
It's our purpose here in this show to give you the restaurateur's perspective.
But the restaurant's just out of the store.
And
yep.
so that's what I want to do in this moment. Let's look at the numbers of this. I think most of us would agree. You come in on a slow Tuesday night, and you bring your own pasta, and we deal with that, and it's slow, and I make you your dish on the side. There's no real cost. I understand why they only charge them $12. I wouldn't have done that, just so you know. I would have charged you the regular price of the entree.
Right.
So the pasta with marinara, whatever that is on my menu, that's what I would have charged you for.
Yes.
The pasta that you brought. But let's talk about the cost to the restaurant bringing your own pasta in on a busy night. Well, let's take an average restaurant, which runs with a 6-burner stove and a pasta machine, pasta maker. Okay. And that pasta maker basically is something that speed boils water.
Just keeps a lot of water hot for a long time without having to recover.
Okay, so let's say in that six burners on a Saturday night, all six burners are going all night long, and the pasta maker is going all night long. A gluten-free order comes in. One of the burners is now out of the circuit.
Because I can't use the water in the pasta machine.
Because
I
can't use the water in the pasta machine. It's got gluten in it. So now I begin to boil your water. I now have one of my burners. Takes 12 minutes to bring your water to a boil. Gluten-free pasta, anywhere from another 10, 12 minutes to cook that pasta, another 6 minutes to do whatever I'm going to do in the pan, toss it, plate it, put it in the window. So I've now taken one of the 6 burners for 30 minutes.
Out of commission on Saturday
night. Out of commission on Saturday night, and where I'm making your food. Every entree goes in a pan for about 6 minutes one way or another. That means that six-burner area is putting out 60 entrees per hour. By taking one burner out for half an hour...
50 entrees per hour?
It's now putting out, 50 entrees per hour. Now, or 55 because it's only a half an hour. Depending on how busy I am, either every patron in the restaurant is waiting four more minutes for their entrees.
Right.
Or I'm serving 55, 56 people, including you, instead of 60 people in that hour. There's a cost to that on Saturday night.
Right.
Saturday night is prime time. You've cost me four, but your two entrees have cost me four other people being able to have dinner in my restaurant during that hour. Now you've come in.
Or you've caused people to wait at the bar.
Correct.
Or you've caused four people to wait 15 minutes at the bar.
So either you've added half an hour, four people to wait half an hour at the bar. So either you've added another customer's dissatisfaction or you've reduced the number of people that I can serve in the evening.
Right.
It's one of those two things.
Right.
Now what you would like is for me to serve you, to charge you less. Okay, you're a regular customer. I want you to keep coming. You came on Thursday. You came on a Tuesday. That's great. So I'm going to accommodate this request, even though it's causing other issues for my customers. To think that that should be discounted, you're not counting the other cost to my business.
Right. You haven't made my life easier. You've made my life harder.
And you don't understand that. So now I'm going to go into the restaurants.com thing. So that's if there's no coupons involved. That's just regular. You've either cost me four other customers that night, or you've cost
four customers to wait 15 minutes. And what he means by four other customers is sometimes when you say to people, hey, I'll have a table for you in 15 minutes, they say, especially in a town like Red Bank, lots of restaurants, they say, no, we'll go someplace else.
Exactly.
And that's how you lose those four customers. Because you say, or in a more likely scenario, makes sense to everybody, where normally you'd say to a lot of people, I'll have a table for you in 15 minutes. Most people are going to say yes. But if you were running the 15-minute wait, and now you say, I'll have a table for you in 30 minutes.
Right.
They say, no, we'll go someplace else.
So, I mean, these are real numbers. This is real-life restaurant-owning, restaurant-running. These are the kinds of things that you need to consider whenever you make a decision in your restaurant. You have to consider the numbers of the restaurant, period. So, but I want to accommodate my customer. I always want my customer to leave with a smile on their face. I always want to do whatever I can to make that customer happy, so I do it. But I can't discount that. And then again, to discount that, restaurants.com. Now, I'm not exactly sure how restaurants.com goes, but let me give you Groupon as an example. Okay? Groupon, you pay 50 cents on the dollar. Well, Groupon takes half of that money, so they keep 25 cents on a dollar. Not that we've ever done Groupon, but they've approached us,
so I know
how their formula works. So basically, if you use a Groupon, the place is going to get 25 cents on the dollar. So now you've asked them to take half the money of a regular entree. You've asked them to take 25 cents on a dollar. So basically what you said is, I want to pay you $4 an entree, even though I'm costing you four entrees when I walk in the door.
Right.
That's just unreasonable. And what I understand is, I understand the patron doesn't understand the back of the house business. The
right.
people who listen to this show probably are more in tune with something like that.
Think about this. You know, how much does a box of pasta cost?
Mm-hmm.
A box of pasta costs, you know,
even gluten-free pasta, $3?
$3. But the pasta, so say I was going to charge $20 for a bowl of pasta. Well, honestly, the pasta in that pasta costs me no more than it costs you. I pay wholesale. It costs me less.
Right.
So the pasta in your pasta really only costs you a buck, right? So you're like, oh, here, I'll pay for the pasta. And then you don't get the pasta or the markup on the pasta. And here's the thing. Restaurants run these days, this is real number, 7% profitability is doing great, which means of every $100 that comes in, the restaurant at the end of the year has in profit $7. I can't discount your bill like that.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is 93% of the money is being spent on something. Typically, in an Italian restaurant like that, you're talking about a 27, 28% food cost. So of that $100, $28 is food cost. Well, you know, but you've only got $7 left, right? So $65, 65%
right. Look at Francis doing math on the fly for you guys, okay? It's happening.
65% of the cost of your dish is not the food at all.
Mm-hmm.
And with pasta, honestly, there is a high gross profit margin on pasta, which is why pasta is less expensive than other things, because we need to make a certain number of dollars per person that comes through the door, because we have to pay for a certain number of chairs, we have to pay for a certain number of tablecloths and linens
and
the
chefs,
heat, and chefs
and people and waiters, and that's the part that I think sometimes that people don't understand. There's a certain, and this is the part that this person didn't understand, certain dollar per person that I have to bring in on a Saturday night.
Right. You come in and you order a pasta, and you tell me you're on a gluten-free diet. It means you don't order an appetizer. You don't order dessert. If you come in and sit at a table, and then you give me a coupon that you paid 50 cents on the dollar for, and I get 25 cents on the dollar for, if you come in and spend 20 bucks, I get $5.
Mm-hmm.
And then you want a through $4 discount. There comes a point where the restaurant has to say, hey, no. I think the person bamboozled here was the restaurateur. I think the restaurateur had the press come in and say, listen,
right.
She needed to compromise or it was going to get written bad things about her. I think the restaurateur was totally right here.
So where are we going for dinner this week?
Monticello in Red Bank. I want you all, if you're in a striking distance of Monticello at Red Bank, I want you to go to dinner at Monticello in Red Bank, order something off the menu, pay the full price, and thank the
or
chef.
Or bring your box of gluten-free pasta,
call them
in advance, know that it's going to be full price, and enjoy it. And enjoy the restaurant and its ambiance.
And the owner's last name is Giambalzo. Please tell her the restaurant guy sent you. And if you want to send a respectful letter to a very good reporter who maybe got this one not exactly right and you have a different opinion, send her a letter. It's bamboozled@starledger.com. Karen Price Mueller is her name. Be respectful. She's a very good reporter. She's trying to do the right thing, but I think that she got this one a little bit wrong. And if you want to tell us we're morons, feel free, as many times as you like.
If you want to tell us we're morons,
Mark
you send it to Francis at restaurantguysradio.com.
I got bamboozled. We're really curious to hear what you think. Whatever you think, either way, you can email me, Francis@restaurantguysradio.com.
Feel free to disagree with us.
Yeah.
Because we disagree with each other all the time.
I know, we'd love to know what you have to say. Francis@restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment with a great guest. Stick with us. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. And our guests today are Anastasia Miller and Jared Brown. You may have read any of their 30 books on cocktails that they have written before, including Shaken, Not Stirred, A Celebration of the Martini. Their masterwork, the two-volume Spiritus Journey, A History of Drink, charts the history of spirits and mixed drinks from 7,000 B.C. to the 20th century. These guys are fantastic. They write for Food Arts, Wine Spectator, Cigar Aficionado, and their new book is The Deans of Drink, The Amazing Lives and Turbulent Times of Harry Johnson and Harry Craddock.
Anastasia and Jared, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on The Restaurant Guys for the first time. We've read a number of your books over the years, and we seem to run in the same circles because we sort of see we are ships passing in the night in many different places. And when I read your current book, I had to have you on the show to talk about it. I think it's inspired and interesting and different. The title of the book is The Deans of Drink, The Amazing Lives and Turbulent Times of Harry Johnson and Harry Craddock, as seen in a new light. What's the new light?
The fact that both Harrys actually tell us a lot about the bar industry and the history of the bar industry, and how someone who you see as being a bar legend can actually be living quite a dramatic life in the background. You know, so besides making a profound effect like Harry Johnson did in introducing vermouth cocktails, documenting vermouth cocktails for the first time in history, he was also one of the people who experienced what it was like dealing with prejudice in the industry.
Well, talk to us about that.
It wasn't easy being a German-American coming into World War One and even before. So he was facing remarkable prejudice. But the new light that you asked about was delving beyond the books that they wrote and deeply into their personal lives.
Well, and you guys are historians by trade. I mean, that's sort of the signature of everything you've written. You do a wonderful job contextualizing things. I do like that you, in a couple of different iterations, have included recipes in this book, but we can talk about those later. My last name is Schott. I'm mostly Irish, and I'm a quarter German. But my German grandfather, Old Man Schott, I remember during World War One.
You called your German grandfather Old Man Schott?
That's what they called him. Grandpa Schott, would you prefer? But he's not your grandpa. Don't call him that. But during World, he was a cop in
he
town.
He sounds so loving, old man Schott.
I never met him. I never met my grandfather. But he was a cop in town, in a town where his family had been for many, many years. And you know, there were rocks thrown through his windows in his house. You know, and my uncle Patsy Riley was serving in the war, and was killed. You know, in the American forces. But it's funny to think about. For me, prejudice against the Irish, prejudice against the Germans, even before that, it's insane to think about it. But you talk about how it was really hostile here as World War I approached.
Well, it was basically hostile from about the 1860s when Jerry Thomas was running around New York as well. And if you were Irish, good luck. As far as, you know, if you owned a saloon, you were the first people the police would come and crack in on.
Yep.
If there was going to be any trouble, they'd look at the bartender and go, "You're the cause of it, and you're Irish, and you're definitely the cause of it." And the same thing happened with the Germans, because here were the Germans having these little beer gardens, and families would go there with their kids and have a very pleasant time. But good grief, they were German. You know, they couldn't speak English properly. It is one of those dark points in American history that people don't think about, and it's very pertinent to the bartending industry because, in fact, in New Jersey, in New York, most of the establishments are either owned by the Irish or the Germans.
Well, that's because, I mean, and as you talk about in your book, that's because they brought some of their European alcohol culture to puritanical America.
I mean, we would not have cocktail shakers, to be quite honest with you, if it hadn't have been for the Germans bringing in the Doppelfassbecker. Jared loves talking about the Doppelfassbecker.
Isn't that when someone looks like you?
The cocktail shaker was invented somewhere around 1870 because that was the first American patent for a cocktail shaker.
Uh-huh.
The truth is, they had these interlocking metal cups in German taverns back to the 1400s. And I can't imagine German tavern owners having these interlocking cups sitting around for centuries without having put them to any use.
And what did you call them again? A doppel what?
Doppelfassbecker, which translates to double barrel beaker.
I thought that was just when you saw someone who looked a lot like someone else and they were, oh, that's it. It's different.
Well,
I guess that's different.
If you see one that looks a lot like one, that would be the Doppelfassbecker's doppelganger.
Got it.
You know what? Thank you for going to the next step with that. I appreciate that. Now, the
usually when I call somebody a Fassbecker, I mean something completely different.
Another question I have about American bartending is the knowledge we grew up with, or the knowledge that I have ingrained, is that one of the things that set the American cocktail apart was its use of ice, which of course implies a shaker as well. Talk to me about ice and where that did that come from Europe as well? What was the relationship of ice in Europe and in America?
No, now that is the one true thing that we believe was the high point of American contributions to drinks. Was the fact that Frederick Tudor, who was a Bostonian,
mm-hmm.
came up with a great idea of selling ice from Walden Pond and Wenham Lake, where there's this beautiful crystal clear ice. And they actually went out, sawed the stuff, brought the horses in, brought the carts and a bunch of hay, and took the ice and went out and sold it. I mean, talk about the most unbelievable business plan on earth.
Right.
You live in a place where there is plenty of beautiful crystal clear ice, and you just chop it up and sell it to the rest of the world.
That's pretty smart.
And he really did sell it to the rest of the world as well. In 1806, Frederick Tudor made his first ice shipment from Boston, and he sailed that ice all the way to Martinique. On arrival, he realized he should have probably built an ice house first, so he had a bit of a fire sale on his ice.
Oh, so he got it there, but when he got it there, there was nowhere to keep it.
Exactly. And the irony is the next place he went the next year was to Cuba. And Cuba was one of those places that instead of the hospitals and doctors who really appreciated it because it was the only relief that anybody who had yellow fever could have was being cooled off with ice. Cuba had another group of people who went absolutely passionate for the stuff. It was the bodega owners, the guys who owned bars.
Yeah, sure.
And they loved it.
You know,
I always remember when I first traveled to Europe when I was, you know, 24 years old, and I went, and I don't know what I ordered, and I said, I'll have that with ice. And there was one lonely cube floating in my drink, and I thought, can I have 30 times?
They actually found one?
Yeah. No, and I was like, they're like, you want soda with ice? I said, yeah. And he reached with his little tongs, and he put two ice cubes in my soda, and I thought, are you serious? And then I saw what they meant by a sandwich, and I really was like, what the hell are you guys talking about?
After coming, I lived a summer in Europe, and after coming back, I remember the two things I wanted were I wanted a drink filled with ice and a shower curtain.
Shower curtain? Are you insane?
Yeah.
In desperately short supply of shower curtains in France.
Yes, I didn't get it. I didn't understand that.
But we had to smuggle a shower curtain from IKEA. And because we were living in France working on the restoration of the museum, and walked into the apartment and went, hey, guess what's missing?
Well, we should talk about that for a moment. You guys are co-founders of the Museum of the American Cocktail with so many of other of our friends, including Dale DeGroff. And you also have just finished a project opening a cocktail museum, a libation museum in Europe. Want to tell us about that?
Well, actually, the museum was already standing since 1958. It was founded and built by Paul Ricard, or Pernod Ricard, and it was on his private island, Ile de Bandeur. No one had actually opened the doors and seen what was inside of this museum since 1964. And we had someone who actually called us up and said, hey, do you want to come down to Ile de Bandeur and, you know, we'll check it out, and it's in the Riviera, so it's kind of cool. And I went, okay, let's go. Well, they opened the door, and then they locked us inside. And after they took our jaw off the floor, which it was literally on the floor.
Why, what did you see?
10,000 bottles, murals, hand-painted murals all over the building. It was literally a cathedral to wine and spirits that had remained untouched until we walked in 2006.
And then what did you guys do to it to get it open?
We cleaned, restored, photographed, documented, looked up histories, cataloged everything.
Mm-hmm.
Then Jared, for some reason, found in one refrigerator room in this old butcher shop area, found about 1,200 menus dating back to the 1800s.
Wow.
That's great.
So to put it mildly, every summer for 3 years, we spent, was it 5 months?
Well, the first year we were there for 9 months. The second year we were there for six. The third year we were there for 5 months.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, doing a lot of traveling, either with presentations about the museum or working on building its education program, or occasionally getting to work on further acquisitions. We added another 1,000 bottles to the collection while we were there.
Who endowed this museum? Where does the money come from?
From the Ricard family.
Ah, they have some, I hear. They've got some of the cash laying around.
So, they got a dollar.
And is it now open to the public?
It is open to the public in the summer. So I believe it's just from through July and August or by appointment.
Well, and so can we get a website or how would people find out about
this? Oh, yes. If you want to have a look at the museum, you can check it out online at www.euvs.org. That's www.euvs.org.
And we'll put that on Restaurant Guys Radio, too. So
yeah, check under the show at restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll link you there. If you're driving, don't get in an accident trying to write that down. We'll have it for you when you check with us later. Well,
it's a lot easier than trying to spell out the actual name of the museum.
Yeah, I figured that. That was really wise. We will spell out the actual name. Well, one of our assistants will spell out the actual name of the museum on the website.
There you go.
So let's go back to your book. Your book was really fascinating. It's split into two parts, Harry Johnson and then Harry Craddock, and Craddock and Harry Johnson's careers overlapped, but you know Harry Johnson sort of was coming to a close at the beginning of Harry Craddock's career. What's the lineage there? What happened? What did each man bring to the profession? What was different about them?
Well, you can say that Harry Johnson was actually the man who truly did document America's contribution to a style of drink, which was vermouth cocktails. The martini, the Manhattan, keep going. He was the first one to actually document those drinks. and encourage people to look at how many different variations now you can do it. I mean, there was like, was it five different variations on the martini alone?
Yep, yep.
How many cocktails did he have in the book?
200-something.
Yeah, a lot of people talk about Jerry Thomas being the father of modern bartending,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of the cocktail, in 1862, Jerry Thomas included 10 drinks under the name, or 10 drinks under the heading cocktail.
Right.
Harry Johnson had somewhere in the neighborhood of 250.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's what really struck me, and I do know the history of some of these guys before, and one of the things that I found very interesting was it's about these two guys, but there's a whole cast of characters, including Ada Johnson and all the other bartenders that were contemporaneous through both of these men's lives. And what I really found wonderful about this book was it sort of contextualized these stories in relation to each other. And the whole time I'm thinking, you know, this is, you know, we think of Jerry Thomas as the, it was, I think sometimes we get a false impression that Jerry Thomas started cocktails and did it by himself for 25 years, and then other people began. Whereas that's not really the case, and you really get a sense of that with this book.
No, well, you see, that's the thing. I think because once you latch on to a hero, it's kind of hard to look for other heroes or understand, you know, what how many different facets the person can have. I mean, it's like the same thing happens in food. When if you met for the first time in your life, Paul Bocuse, you might think, okay, that's the epitome of all chefs.
Right.
And then, of course, you have to run into, what's his name, Anthony Boudrin? Yeah. Completely different type of guy.
Right.
And it's that same kind of thing. Jerry Thomas was the closest thing to the ultimate flair bartender in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He was a showman. He was a show-off. He beat his own chest constantly. Harry Johnson seemed to be more of the intellectual type. He was actually much more of a businessman. I mean, you've got to figure, he was spending a lot of time, especially after 1888, where he was doing consulting work with other restaurants and other potential bar owners and trying to teach them how to train up staff and da-da-da-da-da. So he was a lot more of a really boring, nerfy kind of guy. The funny thing is both Johnson and Craddock were kind of nerfy like that. You know, ooh, let's keep an index box of every single drink that, you know, a customer comes up with or he came up with or he found because he'd been trained to do it. And, you know, who else would sit there and obsess with a database?
But those are the people who are so important when, as a historian, that to look back on, because those are the people who are cataloging all of this information for us so that we can look back at it.
And thankfully, Harry Craddock was going one step further and was a vocal defender of the cocktail and of drink in general. During Prohibition, there were grumblings in Europe as well. And in England, there were people speaking out against the cocktail as being detrimental to the individual and detrimental to society. And then there were letters from Harry Craddock to the newspapers laying down very logical arguments for the cocktail.
And what kind of arguments would he employ?
He was pointing out that the cocktail was very beneficial to the digestion when taken one cocktail before a meal. He was pointing out that people generally had better health if they had one or two cocktails a day.
I knew I'd like this guy.
Well, it's something that we've since proven, I mean, with scientific
facts.
Yeah,
sure. To have a drink is a good thing. I think also he was traumatized, though. He had been bartending in New York and Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of those bartenders who had to emigrate.
Who got ousted.
Well, yeah. I mean, here he thought that he'd found, you know, you could imagine, this guy came from a wool mill town, just about 20 minutes away from our house, in fact, and yeah, you know, he was going to be doomed to either be a weaver in a textile mill or a tailor or, you know, a yarn maker or something. And he just wanted to be something more. So when he came to the U.S. and he found himself the perfect job, okay, so he did lie about how much experience he had when he first got started. And, of course, everybody took him to task for it. But, you know, I can't think of a single person who starts out in the bartending industry who hasn't lied to get his first job as a barback.
That's funny.
His first customer did take him to task. The first customer Harry Craddock ever served walked up, Harry had just stepped behind the bar because the bartender had walked away, and he wanted that job. So the customer said, give me a tin roof cocktail. And Harry said, I'm sorry, I don't know that one. The bartender said, or the customer said, oh, no problem, I'll walk you through it, and told him how to mix it. And then Harry looked at him and said, why is it called the tin roof cocktail? And the customer looked at him and said, because this one's on the house.
That's funny.
Ouch.
You know,
you know what? I like the little pun here of he had to spin some yarns in order to not spin yarn.
That's a really great.
Oh, that's very good. I like that one.
Francis, by the look on Francis' face, he doesn't like it as well as you two.
I think
do.
It's a reach like I've never heard before, but I'll go along if everyone, if you all outvote me.
I'm happy with that one.
All right.
One of the big discoveries about him and about that was that we'd all thought that Harry Craddock was American.
Right.
He was certainly touted in every newspaper. From the Times of London to the New York Times as being the American.
And he was as American as I am, which is not at all. You just learn how to speak a second language after 20 years.
You know.
He'd actually gotten his U.S. citizenship in 1916, just 4 years before he returned to England.
You know, I was thinking back on that line to get your first bartending job. I think that's harder to do now because the information is out there, but it was nobody ever when I started looking for a job as a bartender, no one ever hired a bartender that didn't have experience. Now that math just doesn't work, right?
Yep.
I mean, on the face of it, that you would never hire someone who didn't have experience. And in New York bars, you would never hire anyone without New York experience. Now,
yep.
That just doesn't work because they can't inject you with experience. But I likewise, fortunately, my cousin owned a bar, and I pushed the envelope a little bit. He did actually train me behind his bar for 4 or 5 days before he said that I was his bartender when I had been his waiter. And
that helped.
It really helped, and I got my first job, and I was there not a month when a guy named Chip, who was the number one customer of this very nice restaurant,
I remember Chip.
Walked in. And this is back when you could smoke indoors. And after his lunch, he used to eat dinner there 4 or 5 days a week, lived in the hotel across the street in the luxury suites, drank, spent a lot of money there. And he kind of took a liking to me as the new green bartender. And he put his very, very big, very, very expensive, very, very Cuban cigar down on the bar. And he smoked it for a couple of minutes. Then it went out. So I threw it away. And he really... I almost lost my job that day.
Yeah, that would be one way of doing it.
And he's like, well, it went out. He's like, yeah, it goes out a lot of times. He's like, that's a $25 cigar back in 1986. And I thought,
but
I didn't lose my job that day, but I should have. And that was my beginning.
And Chip
story.
Still liked you.
Yeah.
Chip still liked you.
We recovered from that, but it took a little while. So
I felt lucky that when I went for my first bartending job, which was a hell of a lot earlier than that, 1968, that I got lucky because my dad had taught me how to make a drink.
Uh-huh.
So when I walked into this bar in Chicago on Rush Street, and they said, okay, so show me how to make a whiskey highball. Good grief. A lot of technique there.
Right.
All I had to do was that, fill out an application, prove that I was over 16, and have a Polaroid taken of me.
A Polaroid.
To see whether or not I looked right for the job.
Oh, that's awesome. That's illegal now.
Yeah, I know, thank God.
Yeah.
It was kind of cool back then because he said something like, wow, I actually look okay. Great.
That's funny. Well, now, Harry Johnson made some moves to organize bartenders, and Harry Craddock did start a Bartenders Guild in London, right, in the end?
Yeah, Harry Johnson gave a good try, but, you know, at the time, it wasn't exactly the most positive thing on earth. The UKBG was at a right place at the right time, because you had a lot of people coming from all over the world. More than not, it was the Americans who were causing a lot of problems, coming into a bar in London and saying, make me a Manhattan, and the bartender making some kind of sludge, to be quite honest, with one ice cube. And so, you know, the idea of unifying all of the London hotel bars, nightclub bars, blah, 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 standardizing the drinks, teaching people how to give good service to American businessmen
and
rich Americans.
And it worked.
A lot. It boosted the industry. People kept their jobs. So it was one of those things where right time, right place. Johnson was just wrong timing, great thought.
Well, you know, we have to take a quick break, but I hope that you'll stick with us. We'll come right back, and I do want to talk about some of the contemporary bartenders in your book. This is a brilliant way to organize this, the contemporary bartenders in your book and their takes on these two iconic bartenders from history. Can you stick with us for a little bit?
Sure.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to us on The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.
Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and we're having a lovely conversation with Jared Brown and Anastasia Miller. Their current book is The Deans of Drink, The Amazing Lives and Turbulent Times of Harry Johnson and Harry Craddock. You can find out more about the book and actually pick it up. We'll give you the link on our website at restaurantguysradio.com. Please go there. And we were talking before the break about the content in the book is really great, both with the historical recipes, putting them in context, and it's an engaging story about the life of these guys, and it traces two lifetimes, two generations of bartending and cocktail culture on two continents. But what I've never seen before is you went to a lot of contemporary bartenders, many people whom we know and respect, and you asked those bartenders about how these guys influenced their bartending and their cocktail making. And then they also give some sort of tribute drinks to Craddock and Johnson. First of all, how did you think of that? It's a brilliant idea. And then talk about some of the more interesting cocktails and contributions that you feel that you got in those sections.
Well, cocktail making and bartending, though it's got a great history, it's also a living history. When people talk about a cocktail renaissance or a cocktail golden age, we're in the midst of the greatest cocktail golden age in the history of bartending.
Hear, hear.
There's no question.
Without a doubt.
Bartenders have reached back and brought back the professionalism that we saw with Jerry Thomas, with Harry Johnson, with Harry Craddock. That's back into the profession, but they've also got social media. They can communicate as never before.
Right.
So
right.
A bartender in Brisbane comes up with a fabulous new take on a classic. 20 minutes later, it's being tested at the Artesian Bar at the Langham Hotel in London.
Right.
And then it leaps over to a place in New York.
Yep. It's true.
It's wonderful to see passion traveling at those speeds. And so we couldn't resist reaching out and letting a lot of other people who love these same historic bartenders join us in a tribute.
It's
also the point of trying to get people to understand there's a certain level of universality, not homogeneity.
Sure.
Attached to a lot of classic cocktails. I'd have to say Harry Johnson, Harry Craddock, Trader Vic, Patrick Gavin Duffy. These guys, you can take that, you take any of those books to anywhere, including Shanghai, and the guy will go, "Oh, Patrick Gavin Duffy." And there'll be some cocktail that just resonated like crazy. And rather than just replicating it, the person's taken it, done some regional fixes, just because the palate's different in every single country, every single place you go. But definitely keeping the tone, the flavor, and just making it much more familiar and more comfortable to the person's customers.
Yeah, you
so
know.
So that was the point we wanted to make. You're not here, because there was a certain point in our history back in the 90s where everybody wanted to replicate precisely what they had in a book.
Yeah.
Well, that is kind of useless, because the booze is better now.
Right.
The ingredients are better now.
Right.
We have better, fresher, local sources for all the garnishes and things.
Well,
and so we'll never be able to replicate perfectly any recipe you find in any cocktail book.
And better,
and thank goodness, because basically what we have today is better drinks in the end than they had 100 years ago.
You know, I think it's interesting from an cultural, from an anthropological perspective to try and replicate what was there. But, you know, you never make a recipe, as it were. I mean, you know, we started our cocktail program in 92, and we were looking at historical recipes or even recipes from other bartenders, and we rejigger them slightly.
My own recipes change depending on what ice I'm using or how, if the lime is sweet or not sweet.
And the other thing is what I think a lot of folks are, thank heaven, realizing now is in depending on what brand of spirit you use, mm-hmm. you know, there's tequila and there's tequila. There's gin and there's gin, you know. And
oh, don't remind me.
Yeah, well, I mean, you guys know.
For 2 weeks, and I can tell you, tequila is different from one end to the other. We were just in Cuba, where we've been trying to explain to people that you say, well, you know, I want to do a Cuban cocktail program. Great. Find yourself some key limes. You can't use Persian limes.
Huh.
Find yourself some yerba buena seeds, not the one with Y-E-R-B-A, but H-I-E-R-B-A, which is very unique to the Caribbean. And start planting your own mint.
Right.
Because that spearmint and peppermint ain't going to work.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then forget about putting a bunch of ice in it.
Right. You know, it's funny. We'll change... We changed tequilas. We had a tequila from a very respected brand that changed ownership recently, and a few years back. And the first thing that went was their sort of B-level tequila that was our house tequila, which had been a great buy and was a great, you know, gave the flavor we wanted for our recipes. And all of a sudden, our cocktails were different. And even if it had gotten better instead of worse, it's still different, and you've still got to change the cocktail. You know, so talk to us about who were the people. Give us one or two examples of people that you spoke to in this book who you thought, wow, that person made a great contribution to the book.
Alex Cortina and Monica Berg. Alex Cortina is the head bartender for the Artesian Bar at the Langham Hotel in London.
Been there several times.
His girlfriend Monica is the bar manager for the Aquavit Bar in Oslo, Norway.
Huh.
And, you know, just watching what happened when the two of them said, okay, here's two different takes on exactly the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
I had to congratulate them for batting heads.
Right.
Backwards and forwards. The same thing with Samir and Take Mina Hamara. It was like, okay, we understand that being couples, that, you know, you have different takes on things and you try different recipes a different way. They just showed how well that works. I was also surprised by this guy, Leszek Satra, who's from Poland, but he works in Copenhagen. And literally, I said, you know, you're running a little late in getting a recipe to me. And we actually sat on Facebook, and he was working the recipe and actually experimenting with it and typing at the same time.
That's great.
And then all of a sudden, go, wait a minute, change that one. Wait a minute, change that one. And it was like, good grief.
That's funny.
And so, the result was a great drink.
It's a fabulous drink. In fact, he entered it into the bowls around the world competition.
Do you
semifinalist with it.
Do you remember the drink that Alex contributed?
Oh, Lord, no. That's embarrassing.
It's okay, though. You didn't know there was going to be a quiz. I didn't let you know in advance. I will.
Oh, Anastasia's just thinking about it, and it'll all come to her as she rolls it around her palate.
Thanks.
Yeah, it takes me a minute to think about it.
Anastasia, I'm not sure what cocktail I had with dinner last night, so don't feel too badly.
The I can't even say it. That's why I couldn't remember it. Chrysanthema.
And
in chrysanthemum, but chrysanthema. And it's Benedictine Suze Bruinard Blanc de Blanc and a Salvatore Dali d'Alessine.
What is that last thing you just said?
Oh, if I know.
And just for, so those of you listening may not, so those of you listening may not have heard of Suze before. Suze is now available in the United States again. It's
Gentian based.
Out there.
Bitter, yeah. Delicious.
I used to have to bring it in from the UK for my friend Audrey Saunders because she couldn't get any unless she was over here and, you know, visiting and just sticking more stuff in her luggage. Or
do you want to hear? Do you want to hear something a little parallel in our lives? There was a time when the Pegu Club first opened that they, for some reason, didn't have Laird's Bottled and Bond Apple Brandy available in New York. And there, I mean,
what? Really?
Yeah, the Bottled and Bond wasn't available for like 6 or 8 months, and so all they could get was the regular stuff. And so I would bring some like in a trench coat and be like, "Here's the Bottled and Bond," you know,
fabulous.
In the back. Not as exotic as your stuff. Well, listen, guys, I think the book is terrific, and we recommend it very highly. If you're listening out there in listener land and you want the title one more time, it's The Deans of Drink, The Amazing Lives and Turbulent Times of Harry Johnson and Harry Craddock. Those are not the only people in this book. There's a cast of characters from the days of yore and a lot of great contemporary bartenders. There are tremendous recipes in this book, which you should use as a guide and adjust to yourself in your own way. And if you look at the contemporary bartenders, you will find you should visit their bars at some point if you can. You're in striking distance, and you'll find yourself at some of the best bars being served by some of the best bartenders in the world.
If you want to drop into a great legacy bar, Harry Johnson's nephew opened a place on 36th Street and 6th Ave in New York. It's still open today.
What's it called?
Keen's Steakhouse.
Oh.
That's funny.
Yeah, I've spent many an evening that I remember the beginning of at Keen's Steakhouse.
That's funny.
And if you peek behind the bar, that's basically the bar as illustrated in Harry Johnson's Bartender's Manual.
That's really fascinating.
That's
wonderful.
And now you just connected two dots for me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that was really great. That's really great. So Anastasia and Jared, thank you for joining us on the show. Your book is great. You've been great company. Thanks for having us. And,
thanks very much, guys.
Thank you for inviting us.
And I'm sure we'll see you around on the circuit. You guys stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. I like those guys. They're great.
That was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. Well, they really know their history.
They do. You know, I've loved their books. We've crossed paths with them. We've been within 10 feet of them probably 30 times, and just for some reason, we've never really connected.
I was actually at a seminar at Tales of the Cocktail that Anastasia was one of the panelists.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, they're super smart people, and they're super fun people we know now, and their books are great. I really do recommend it. It's funny, as you're looking at all this stuff, one of the things that's been very important is I remember our friend Dusan Zarek once said at a seminar that he and I were giving together, and he was talking about bartending versus mixology. And he said, listen, you have to bartend. You have to tend the bar, and that means tending the people at the bar and then bringing them the drinks, and you need to have that expertise to make the drinks. But, you know, he said, there are so many guys, and I said, because this discussion started when I was talking about I was at a place, and these guys were mixologists, but they weren't bartenders, and they were pissing me off. I'm like, you make an excellent drink, but I think you're an asshole. I'm never coming back here again. What? Congratulations, you know? As opposed to, hey, this drink isn't very good, but that's a really nice guy. Maybe I'll come back someday. You know, if you can only have one, I'll take the bartender. And Dusan said to me, I can't do Dusan's accent, but everything has a little more weight in Dusan's accent. And he said, you know, the world is full of all these people that instead of learning how to take care of people, they try to know exactly how many hairs were on that Jerry Thomas had on his mustache, and they think that makes them a good bartender. And there was for a time, and this is, gratefully, this is fading away, a number of people who were so interested in looking at the past, knowing everything about the past, and recreating the past, that you lose the point. You know, cocktails are not a museum, but you look at the past to be informed about the past, to make that part of your present and bring things into the future.
You know, you were exactly right. You can't do Dusan's accent.
I didn't try. That wasn't even me trying.
You almost tried.
Would have been ridiculous.
Honestly, my favorite part of the whole show was them putting together for me that picture of Harry Craddock standing in front of the bar and putting it together with, that's the Keen's Chop House Bar.
Well, it's his nephew that did the Keen's Chop House Bar. But yes, that's where the lineage goes back.
But that's unbelievable. I mean, it just put that all together for me. That's, you know, you can almost see it in your mind's eye.
And, you know, Keen's Chop House, we spent many evenings at Keen's Chop House, many afternoons. We went out for lunch to Keen's Chop House and wound up being there many, many evenings.
Yeah, that was a place that Francis and I.
And you know that the guy who built, when single malt scotches were sort of returning to America in the 80s. The guy who put the Scotch collection there, and it's one of the best Scotch collections in the city for many, many years, was our friend Corey Hill, who is also a bartender and still in business.
I remember early in the 90s being introduced to Springbank Scotches at Keene's Chop House.
By Corey Hill?
Doing a whole Springbank tasting.
Yeah.
And saying, wow, these are special and interesting and maybe my new favorites.
Wild stuff. Keene's Chop House, famous for the mutton chop.
Mutton chop is it.
Not really a mutton chop, but, you know, not really a lamb chop.
It's like a big lamb chop.
A mutton chop or a lamely mutton chop. Yeah, it's good, but it's delicious. So, in this book, you have Ada Coleman, who was the head bartender at the Savoy Hotel in London before Harry Craddock. And they worked there together, right? I was at... Another gentleman in this book is the current head bartender at that hotel, who's a guy named Eric Lawrence, and I was at that hotel with him last year, the year before last. He's a great and talented bartender. And one of the things they have on their cocktail menu there is they have a list of former head bartenders going all the way back to Ada Coleman. So it's like, you know, the presidents of the United States. You know, there's a history of the bar that really reaches very far back in time.
It's like the presidents of the United States.
Well, no.
Is that the analogy you really wanted to use?
You know, it's like the era, it's a continuous cycle. It's been handed from one head bartender to the other, and they take it very seriously, and it really is like reaching back into history, and it's keeping history alive and going for it. Well, I hope you guys have enjoyed that more than Mark, and I hope we see you again next week. The name of the book is The Dean's a Drink. You can find it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Visit there early and often. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.